Hello and welcome. Speaking to Legends podcast. This show is a quest for ideas, insights, and stories from the lives of the most successful hedge fund managers. We learn about their spectacular careers, we share their life lessons, and dissect their investment techniques. We're thrilled by the prospect of sharing educational and thought-provoking content which helps you learn, grow, and think. If you like the show and find it useful, please support it by subscribing and writing a review on iTunes. Help us spread the word and grow the show by sharing it with a friend or two. The legend of today is Steve Mobbs. Steve is a founding partner of Oxford Asset Management, a quantitative hedge fund which peaked at $5 billion in assets under management. In this episode, Steve gives his behind the scene of the hedge fund world and expands on his experience. You will learn how and why his first hedge fund failed and lessons he learned from that experience. How he started Oxford Asset Management and grew it from a small team and $10 million in AUM to a multi-billion dollar powerhouse with 100 employees. Steve also goes in length to discuss the trade-off between being small and nimble versus large and slow to adjust. Let's get right into it. Hi, Steve. Great talking to you. Excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thanks a lot for inviting me, Nikita.
Let's start from your background. You did maths at Cambridge and then economics at Oxford. How did you find those years? And do you think, if at all, it prepared you for starting the career?
Well, I was, I loved my time at university. I mean, I came from a, you know, fairly humble background. I was the first person in my family to go to university. So it was a bit of a revelation for me, really, to go to Cambridge. I mean, I, you know, being a clever kid at school and, you know, you go to university and you find there are quite a lot of clever kids around. You know, I enjoyed maths at first, but, you know, I found it a little more abstract than, you know, certainly school maths had prepared me for. And, you know, I was not sorry to stop doing maths at the end of my time there. You know, I'd always been interested in, you know, politics and you know, I'd considered changing to economics halfway through the Cambridge course, but I kind of decided that I wanted to see it through and get a good degree, which I did. So I went off and studied economics, and frankly, studying economics was something of a revelation for a kid who'd grown up in sort of state-dominated, you know, UK of the 70s. It was, you know, super interesting, and, you know, I sort of looked at the world, you know, encouraged me to look at the world in a somewhat different way. I mean, you asked whether it was, whether I found it useful for my career. I mean, the answer is to a point, but less than you might expect. I mean, I felt that the, you know, in general, the maths was, you know, I've used maths one way or another in, you know, through my career. But I mean, I'm not sure I've used any of the, you know, heavy duty maths or very much of the heavy duty maths we used at Cambridge. In economics, well, you know, I learned some econometrics at Oxford, but I think I more generally just learned to look at the world, you know, of markets and of profits, and, you know, just encouraged me really to look at the capitalist system in a way that you possibly didn't in, you know, in the UK in the mid 70s. So again, enjoyed my time at Oxford, but I came out, you know, very much not knowing anything that was very, very useful or very relevant. And, you know, the finance which I'd learned, very much learned on the job. You know, I read a lot of articles, I read a lot of books, I went, you know, took some courses, and, you know, it was not that I came out of, you know, Cambridge or Oxford with a particular toolkit, but I did come out with a certain amount of self-belief and a belief that I could teach myself stuff that I needed, and I did that really throughout my career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it quite often happens that the start of the career doesn't leverage so much of the skills picked up along the way through the university, but it kind of equips you with tools to just think and how to learn and those kind of things. And it sounds like you found that to be quite useful. And so you started your career and BP, and then went on to into banking, and then spent 10 years at Credit Suisse, First Boston, and Deutsche Bank. While there, you undertook a variety of roles. Can you please expand on your time there and any notable stories you want to share?
Oh, there are so many stories. I mean, the first thing I was going to say was that compared to, you know, kids today, you know, who've all done internships and, you know, are very clued up about, you know, the world of work. You know, my generation was very much less so. I mean, there weren't internships. You know, I pitched up at my first job, which was as a macroeconomist, actually, working for British Petroleum, really super naive about what the working world was like. You know, it took me a year or 2 years really to get used to a working environment. I mean, I wasn't very good in my first job. I mean, I was, I didn't like them and they didn't like me. And it took me a couple of years really to work out that this wasn't a place for me and that I needed to get out. And it was really serendipity that I ended up in the city because, you know, finance was the one thing I wasn't going to do. I was quite left-wing in those days. And I didn't really think that that working in the city seemed didn't seem appropriate for a left-wing kid like me. But I was pretty desperate, actually. I mean, this was the depths of Thatcher's recession. It was extraordinarily difficult to get a job. I must have had about 35 rejections from jobs I applied to when I was at BP. You know, I finally found this job that this wasn't Credit Suisse First Boston, actually. This was a year in a bond fund manager, Bank of America's firm, fund management department. And I was desperate for a job because I really felt I had to get out of BP because I wasn't enjoying it and they didn't like me. You know, suddenly you get to do a job where your skill set is perfect for it and you do it well and you feel that, you know, you just, you know, you go in every day walking on air because you're learning new stuff and super exciting. So I did that for a year. And then I got this extraordinarily good fortune of bumping into an old mate of mine from Oxford who said, "There's Credit Suisse of Boston, which is like the best, really the best investment bank at the time," said, "Oh, you know, we're setting up a research department. What are you doing these days?" And I said, "This is what I'm doing." He said, "Oh, you know, you sound like exactly the kind of guy that we need. Why don't you come in and meet my boss?" And I did. And, you know, I was exactly what they needed. And I had exactly the right skill set for what they were doing. And I joined, you know, CSFB's bond research department. And I knew a bit about bond research and I taught myself an awful lot more. And I was lucky to work with a guy who was, you know, super kind and, you know, taught me a lot. It was just the most perfect job for 3 years. You know, I loved it. I worked on all sorts of, you know, different problems, which were incredibly interesting. And, you know, I taught myself. At the time, there weren't smart people working in investment. That's not quite fair. There weren't academic people working in investment banks. There wasn't a cadre of sort of PhD mathematicians as there is these days. And in CSFB, which, as I say, had all these interesting stuff going on, there was really just three or four of us sitting in the center of the trading floor trying to work on different problems, build option pricing models, you know, write papers, structure deals, you know, you name it, we did it really. And we were very grateful for us to, you know, to work on that stuff. And it was, the other thing that's worth saying is that it was the time when the PC was coming in, the personal computer, the humble IBM PC, which these days we would, you know, sort of say was trivially, you know, underpowered. You know, the fact that you could do calculations on the fly in the middle of the trading floor just transformed stuff that you could do in finance. If you could program a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, you were hailed as a genius. I was rather fortunate to ride that wave. I did work in the research department there for 3 years until the guy who was put in to run research and expand it and make it into a big marketing effort, he and I didn't get on very well, and I was looking for things I might do to get away from him. Trading was the obvious thing, so I sort of said I'd like to trade. So I went off to the arbitrage department, and where there was three or four, you know, sort of smart guys. You know, I sat down, was given the PC, and told to trade whatever I fancied and try and make some money. Then I had another, you know, piece of extraordinary good fortune that I stumbled on a super inefficient market. Which was the market for Japanese warrants, which was equity warrants, which were long-dated equity options, which is an astonishingly inefficient market, you know, where not many smart people were trying to make money out of it. But there was a huge amount of manipulation and wacky stuff going on. And it was really like the Wild West. Having lost incredible amounts of money in the first few weeks when I tried to figure out what was going on, and having been summoned by the head of trading to try and explain why I'd lost so much money in a short period, and I said to him, this was a guy called Ozzie Grubel, who later went on to run the bank. You know, he said, you know, what's going on? I said, "Ozzie, I have really no idea. I've lost, you know, I built these models, they seem smart, and, you know, I bought this and I sold this, and I've no idea how I've managed to lose so much money. And I was expecting to be sent back to research with my tail between my legs." He said, well, if you can lose this much money this quickly, there must be something really interesting happening in these markets. Keep really small and try and figure out what it is. And I did, and I made, you know, lots of money out of it. You know, later I left CSFB largely imbued with the confidence that I could make money out of this market. And, you know, it was the best, most fun thing I ever did in my career, actually, was trading these you know, wacky long-dated options on dodgy Japanese companies. So that was, you know, that was some of my time at CSFB. It was a fantastic time to be there. It was a time of opportunity. It was a time when everything was expanding. Everyone, there weren't very many people around, you know, that everyone believed in you. Yes, go out and try and do that. You know, people joining an investment bank today, there's so many, you know, clever people around. You get given a very small little role. Here, you know, you felt that the world was your oyster and there was, you know, just stacks of things to be done. It was just a matter of choosing which one was most interesting that day. So those were great times.
Yeah, it sounds like you had lots of responsibility and lots of opportunity to choose what to do and get exposure to all sorts of challenges. And as you say, these days, it's much more a specialist rather than generalist roles that companies, hedge funds, banks, they want you to be in. So kind of leveraging this experience at Credit Suisse, First Boston, how did you get into Deutsche Bank and what was your time there?
Well, I mean, I was a sort of a young man in a hurry, really. And as a lot of young men do, I felt I'd been underpaid 1 year and I felt that my P&L was carrying the department, which probably was. And I felt that I could probably do better elsewhere. I think I was also, as I recall, I think I was slightly miffed that I hadn't been promoted 1 year and, you know, that my extraordinary talents had not been recognized. And as I said, I was a young man in a hurry. So a friend of mine who'd worked at CSFB had gone off to Deutsche Bank and he approached me and they said, we're looking to set up a trading department and, you know, would you like to come and do it? You know, I didn't realize at the time, and this is before Deutsche Bank became a major force in investment banking, I didn't realize what a sort of a sleepy, dopey place it was. That there was a chap there who I worked for who was, you know, trying to make his name in the bank. And, you know, he saw me as somebody who could put some money on the table and make him look like he was, you know, modernizing it. And so I went there, took one chap from CSFB with me and tried to make a go of it at Deutsche Bank. And it was, for a couple of years, it seemed like the most appalling decision, because what I didn't realize was that there are lots of people in Deutsche Bank who really didn't think that the bank should be proprietary trading. That if it should be doing it from Frankfurt, you know, that I shouldn't have been hired. And, you know, I was just desperately unhappy for a year or two. Thought I'd been so happy at CSFB and Deutsche Bank, you know, there were all these obstacles put in our way. You know, we couldn't have this computer because it wasn't a standard. We couldn't trade this. I couldn't have any risk limits. You know, I wasn't, you know, I'd managed to negotiate a share of the profit. But what I had in my naivety failed to realize was that, you know, if you don't have any risk limits and can't take any positions, it doesn't matter what percentage of the profits they're prepared to give you. So, you know, things came to a head when the head of worldwide trading, a fellow called Bart von Ribbentrop, whose father was one of the people who'd been executed after the war, he was the guy who was trying to get me sacked. And, you know, I went over and we had this showdown meeting with him and the chief executive, who was a guy called Rolf Breuer. And Ribbentrop said, he shouldn't be here. He's not reporting to me. I'm really not, you know, I just don't think we should be doing this. And Breuer said, that's fine. He can report to me then. So I basically ended up reporting to the chief executive of Deutsche. And, you know, things got better after that because, you know, he was, he had me under his wing a little. I mean, he didn't spend much time with me, but, you know, people knew he had my back. You know, we got more risk limits. You know, we had a couple of really tremendous years. I expanded the department substantially. You know, we had maybe 20 people at its height. And, you know, things were, you know, for several years, things went swimmingly. Then Deutsche Bank decided that it was going to get serious at investment banking. And it hired a bunch of guys from Merrill Lynch, including a guy called Edson Mitchell. And you can read about this in the book Dark Towers, which has just come out by Ayn Rick, which is the story of how Deutsche, you know, Deutsche sudden its adventures in the world of investment banking. But from my point of view, Mitchell didn't like me, and I didn't like him. And you know, the writing was really, you know, from the outset, because I was not his guy, and I didn't, you know, we had one or two rows about things. He wasn't really a trader. Didn't really understand trading, and so really I was on a declining, you know, on a declining, I was really on the way out. I didn't realize it at the time, and one of the things I look back on, and you know, I think I probably should have resigned rather earlier, but I kept going and kept making some money. But you know, he didn't trust me, and I didn't like him. So you know, in 97 I left, but you know, I had some good years at Deutsche and achieve some good stuff. But I think, you know, one of the things I look back on might be interesting for some of your younger people. I mean, I loved my time at CSFB, and I regarded Deutsche as a job. And, you know, all the people I meet now who work for me at Deutsche said what a fabulous time they had at Deutsche, and it was the happiest time of their career. And I think, well, it wasn't the happiest time in my career. I spent all my time, you know, sort of fighting political battles and trying to protect you guys. But they didn't realize that at the time, which probably means that I did my job right. Whereas I look back with nostalgia at my time at CSFB and, you know, what a wonderful time it was there. And possibly there are some people who were protecting my back and making it easy for me to do my job then. Maybe they didn't enjoy the politics so much.
Yeah, the political component is a quite a time allocation for, especially for more senior guys in big corporations. And back then, like the banks, I guess they were becoming bigger and bigger, but they were still not such a huge driving force as they soon became after that. As you left Deutsche in 1997, you set up a fund. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I set up a hedge fund at the time, and I called it Medici Capital Management. And I had one investor, a firm called Paloma Partners, who's still in business, actually. You know, whose business was basically to seed other funds, but provide them with infrastructure. So I only had one client, which is Paloma, and you know, they gave me money to, you know, to set up, and you know, I hired a bunch of guys, and the idea was to create a, you know, a sort of a lookalike Deutsche trading department. And for a year we did really, really well. We made loads of money, and you know, it was a fantastic start. And then I know you had Victor on a couple of weeks ago. Then Long Term, who's an old friend of mine, then Long Term Capital happened, and you know, we had a lot of similar positions to Long Term Capital, and a lot of other funds that Paloma were backing had similar positions. And Paloma lost a lot of money. We lost some money. And Paloma were over-leveraged, and all of their trading groups had to liquidate. You know, they became one of the big liquidators around the LTCM thing, that, you know, we had to basically unwind all of our positions into a market with no liquidity. And it was kind of a heartbreaking thing to do, as you kind of each day you sell a bit more and the price goes down a bit more. We crystallized all our losses. Paloma crystallized all its losses. Paloma laid off most of its trading funds, including us. So I'm left with 20 guys trying to decide what to do. Clearly, you know, this is not an environment in which you're going to be able to raise money. I did make a, you know, desultory attempt to raise some money. But in the end, you know, I had to shut down the fund, laid off the guys, and, you know, licked my wounds, really. It was a very, very difficult experience. You know, you've made people promises and you can't deliver on it. You know, your confidence is shot because you lost some money in trades you really believed in didn't work out. So I took a couple of years off. My kids were quite young, and you know, I became, you know, I sort of took them to school. I became the guy, the dad on the touchline. We had some fantastic holidays. You know, I did that for 2 or 3 years really, and I was uncertain in my mind at that point as to whether I was really going to go back to finance. I mean, you know, like being immodest, I had enough money to live on for the rest of my life. I mean, I was around 40, just over 40. So, you know, I became a bit itchy, really, because a lot of my friends were doing stuff that was interesting, and I was still pretty interested in finance and was kind of reading about it. So when a chap I knew approached me and said, you know, I'd really like to set up a fund. You know, I don't really know how to do it. I don't have any trading experience, but I can do the, you know, I'm a good computer scientist. You know, we should set up a quant fund together. And I said, I'm not really sure I'm up for it. Andre Stern, his name was. I'm not really sure I'm up for it, Andre. But, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll, you know, you set it up and I'll kind of consult with you and I'll give you a bit of help. But, you know, I don't know. I'm not really sure I want to do it anymore. So he set up, you know, we set up, Oxfam was set up, but of course within about 3 months of giving, you know, going and, you know, giving a bit of advice and showing him and his colleagues, a couple of colleagues how to trade. I was working full time, and you know, I worked full time. You know, after that, this is like something like 2000, really. You know, I did all the research and trading, and you know, because that was what I was good at. Andre did more of the you know, sort of front of house investor relations kind of stuff. He was better at computer science than I was, so the systems infrastructure was his. We set up Oxford Asset Management, which was a quant systematic fund. Now, this was, you know, something we'd always done. I'd always done a bit of, but it was not something that I really, you know, spent most of my time doing at Deutsche. And Deutsche was more of a relative value kind of operation, as indeed was CSFB. But we'd done some quant, and I was pretty confident that we could do quant well. So we set up and we started trading in 2004. And we started with $10 million, and, you know, we gradually grew it. And, you know, it's all very, you know, sort of slow. The growth was steady, slow and steady, really, rather than remarkable. We had pretty good performance, and, you know, it grew in an evolutionary way. People, you know, looked at the performance, they came and assessed us, and, you know, there was a trickle of money coming in. You know, we were pretty successful, I think.
Thank you for sharing this story and for going into details on inner workings and your thinking process at that time. And if you were to reflect right now a little bit more about the approaches and techniques and ideas that went into the first venture versus the second, how similar were they? And perhaps you can also, while answering that, touch upon on the trading. How similar was that?
Well, I think the sorts of people we hired were different. I mean, it's a very different feeling running a quant fund to running a relative value fund, and the sorts of people you tend to hire tend to be different. The quant fund, the sort of CSFB and Deutsche trading was all about, you know, sort of, you know, smart guys who are looking for market anomalies and you know, people with a sort of trading, commercial trading, you know, nous, if you like. Sorts of people you tend to hire in a quant fund tend to be PhD mathematicians, PhD physicists, who are not always quite as, you know, quite as commercial. You know, the sense of the place of the Oxfam was much more of a sort of research operation than a trading floor. People wouldn't come in and say, you know, hey, what's this anomaly in the market at the moment? It was much more, here's a bunch of data, let's go away and do a research project on it. You know, and that's a slightly different feeling. And, you know, I say it's, you know, Oxfam had more of the feel of a, and I think most, you know, quant firms have more of the feel of a sort of a research department of university about them than a buzzy trading floor feel about them. Well, in Medici and, you know, and Deutsche, because I regard them as, you know, being very similar, was, you know, typically you would hire people who were traders, people who had, you know, who had an eye for, you know, market anomalies and for trading and for, you know, for markets. And so still in the world of OTC markets, you know, rather than, you know, quantitative, rather than computer-based trading. And those would be the sorts of people who, you know, who you hired, and those, and, you know, managing traders has its own challenges, and, you know, bringing the best out of them has its own challenges. Whereas bringing the best out of researchers, you know, of sort of quantitative, you know, cerebral university types is, you know, has its own challenges as well, but they're slightly different challenges. You know, Oxfam was, you know, a different environment and felt different.
And as you were kind of riding the wave of success and having some very strong years, Oxfam joined the Billion Dollar Club. And how did your personal day-to-day change as a result of it? And what did the expansion mean to the trading operation of the firm?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I mean, let's just you know, talk through, you know, sort of these, some of the ups and downs of Oxfam. I mean, we grew gradually. We started with $10 million. We were perhaps 100 at the end of the first year, perhaps 200 or 300 at the end of the second year. One of the salient things that happened was the crash of the quant crash of 2007, you know, when, you know, all quant funds lost stacks of money over a 2-3 day period. There was like a big unwinding. It was the beginning of the crash, beginning of the great financial crisis. And, you know, we were very much the canary in the coal mine, we, the quant funds. We lost money over the quant crash, but we only lost the money that we'd made already that year. However, when 2008 happened, we had there were a lot of redemptions, not because we lost money in 2008. Actually, we made money in 2008, but we had effectively, you know, monthly redemptions, which allowed people to take money from us when, you know, the people they really wanted to take their money from, they couldn't get their money out. So we lost a lot of assets under management. And as I say, we got down, having been $1.5 billion, we got down to 700 million. We then gradually began to, because we had good performance over this period, you know, the money gradually started coming in again. And we got up to $1 billion, $1.5 billion. We got up to $2 billion. And we made the decision that we were going to take on more assets. We were going to hire more people, and we were going to expand. So up to this point, we'd been 25, 30 people. And 25, 30 people is an organization. And this is really the answer to your question. 25, 30 people is an organization that is very easy to control. You've got two main partners who are, you know, really completely on top of everything that's happening. I mean, I was on top of, you know, every little piece of research. I kind of knew the equations. I knew it was my baby totally. But once you take on more people and it gets to 50, 60, 70 people, ultimately we became 100 people, it feels very different. It feels different working there. It's a very different firm to control. It's very different. You know, you start having to have, you know, sub layers of management. You start having a whole lot of meetings. You know, there are personnel issues. There are guys, you know, that need to be, you know, that aren't pulling their weight or that aren't doing as well. And it becomes a much less dynamic place. Now, frankly, managing a firm of that size was something that we struggled with. You know, it was much harder than I think either of us, either Andre or I, thought it was going to be. You know, I think if I had my time again, I at least would resist that temptation to grow it. I mean, growing it is very tempting to think all those things that you want to do that you can't quite do because you don't have the resources, or that, you know, you're not quite doing properly, but you can hire a couple of guys to, you know, make that more robust process or a more robust system, or you have better system, better computer, you know, infrastructure that needs several people to manage it. Each individual decision you make is very seductive. It looks like the right thing to do to get better. You know, to get bigger and to get better and to, you know, have guys who specialize in things as opposed to people who do things in a, you know, not quite perfect way, but, you know, you get by. And each of those decisions looks seductive, and you make each of those decisions. And then suddenly you end up with a firm that's 2 or 3 times the size of the previous one, and it no longer has the same dynamism, or it seemed to me that Oxfam at the time lacked the dynamism of the Oxfam when 25, 30 people there. You know, when we was 25, 30 people, you had a new idea, you know, people would work on it overnight, you know, you'd get it working the next day. Suddenly when it was 70 or 80 people, it, you know, you had an idea and it would take a while to finish, and, you know, then you'd need to, you know, someone would need to write production code for it, and it became slower and more stodgy as an organization, whereas, you know, we were super dynamic in the early days. And it was, you know, it was a more fun place to work in the early days, not just for me as the founding partner, but as, you know, if I talked to the, you know, people who were there at the time, they would all say, I think, yeah, it was really great in those days, but, you know, somehow we lost something as it became larger. I wonder whether other firms have the same experience. I mean, I do notice a lot of firms grow successfully and manage multiple offices successfully. I mean, perhaps we were just, you know, perhaps some people are better at it than others. But, you know, I felt that was something we lost along the way.
And if we were just to focus on trading for a second, so obviously as AUM grows and you need to have different processes and improve your infrastructure and all of that, and on top of it, the market impact and all of the costs and fees, there is obviously a benefit to economy of scale and having the AUM, but at the same time, the capacity constraint of some strategies can kick in. And what was your kind of experience on this, while at the same time obviously having some human aspect to the expansion and growth of OXAM?
Well, Nikita, you summarize some of the pros and cons of expansion quite well. We did expand, and we got up to $4.75 billion. You know, some of the good things about that were that we added a lot more trading strategies. We got a more diversified set of income flows. We were able to go out and hire some smart people. We added lots more data sources. We were able to expand some of the, we thought, good strategies that we'd worked on in the previous couple of years that were scalable. Clearly, some of the things we did were not scalable. And it became harder to move money around the market. We spent more time worrying about impact than we had before. So it was a mixed picture, really. I mean, we felt it was the logical thing to do, the next step. But, you know, some things were harder for sure. And as I say, one of the aspects of that was the organizational challenge of managing a larger organization.
Yeah, it's definitely maintaining the growth. There are so many different factors that are at play, so many different cycles of the market. And it's quite chaotic in its nature.
Things become, you know, it's not always, you can't always predict, you know, how, you know, the competition in your space is going to evolve. And I think, you know, there was a lot more, quant became a lot more competitive, you know, at various times over this period. You know, there were some things that we were pretty confident we were going to be able to, you know, generate a lot of money out of our futures operation, for example. We had set up a futures unit, you know, which had, you know, extremely good returns initially, and, you know, we were pretty confident that we were doing some stuff that other futures funds weren't doing, and that we were going to do well at it. In the end, you know, this was, you know, we struggled in futures, but we struggled along with the whole futures industry struggling. But, you know, I don't think it was unreasonable at the time to presume that, you know, that the stuff that we had, you know, developed was going to be successful.
Speaking about evolution of hedge funds, strategies, approaches, techniques, and also the fact that some of these one in a million year events happen every 10 years. And so you spent over 35 years in finance, and you saw the firsthand some of these events, the crash of 1987, the dot-com bust, QuantQuake, and so on. And so these events, to me, are a perfect opportunity for funds that are promising the uncorrelated returns and the advocating the edge that they have. So do you think funds lived up to the expectation in the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I mean, you have to, I'm an outsider now. I'm outside of the industry, and I have been for the last, you know, nearly 2 years. But I think it is one of the sadnesses of the hedge fund industry as a whole is that, you know, it promises uncorrelated returns. And in general, often the returns are uncorrelated, except when the shit really hits the fan, when hedge funds discover that, you know, quite a lot of the things they do are in extremis correlated with, you know, with markets and with risk premia. And, you know, it seems to have been the case with COVID. It certainly was the case in 2007 and 2008. It was the case in 1998. And I'm probably one of the few people around who was trading in 87. And I can assure you the same thing was there then. You know, all these little positions which you had, which you thought were hedged, you know, all managed, and the market goes down 25% overnight, which is a pretty serious stress test, but they all seem to manage to find ways to, you know, to lose money. So, you know, although you've been uncorrelated, you're ostensibly uncorrelated most of the time, when it really matters and when people are really looking at you to be uncorrelated, you know, you seem to manage to be correlated. Now, I think there are reasons for that. You know, there's a lot of hedge funds in a lot of, we're not just talking quant here, you know, take various risk premia. You know, there's an unwinding effect that people go to cash, and that everyone unwinds the same stuff at the same time. But, you know, I do think it is a weakness of the story for hedge funds, which is that, you know, you tell people to go away and should, you know, and calculate your numbers and how uncorrelated you are. But then, you know, once in a blue moon, something happens and, you know, you manage to find ways to lose not just small amounts of money, but quite extravagant amounts of money at the same time that the equity market is going down significantly. So, you know, I think COVID fits into that pattern.
And what kind of your outlook? Because the theme, I guess, throughout our conversation was that the markets got a lot more efficient when in the 80s it was just a couple of guys on the trading floor scribbling some formulas. Right now it's a very proper, sophisticated operation all around, and a lot more minds are spending time on this. What do you think are going to... Will hedge funds have their rebirth, or will it kind of continue to slide as it been the case over the past few years?
I think it's the supply and demand of opportunity. I mean, I think there's a lot of money, you know, chasing opportunities in hedge funds. There's a lot of clever guys who've all been educated in the same place and understand the same things. I think you will always find, you know, that there are really smart people who are better than the others, you know, who will generate supernormal returns. But I think, you know, for the average guy, you know, doing sensible things but not extravagantly different things, it's just become a whole lot harder to make money. You know, when I started out, it was very easy to see how to make money. It was very easy to see where the anomalies were. It was very easy to, you know, to generate, you know, consistent returns and find ways to diversify them across different strategies. I think it has just gradually become a whole lot harder. A lot more money has been, you know, is chasing it. In terms of whether hedge funds, you know, how hedge funds continue to do, I mean, I think, you know, the expectations around hedge fund returns have become much more, you know, become much lower and, you know, arguably more realistic. I mean, you know, the time in the, you know, the 90s when, you know, people would expect double-digit returns from a hedge fund and, you know, mid-teen returns, you know, I think those are long gone. And, you know, I think institutional investors really are now looking for something that is uncorrelated and, you know, which offers, you know, reasonable returns. So, you know, I don't think the hedge fund industry is dying, but I don't think it's any longer as, you know, sexy and exciting. And I don't think that the claims, you know, for excess returns are, you know, can possibly be as extravagant as they were. And I think if you invest in hedge funds in general, as opposed to the perhaps the top decile or so of them, then I think you're going to get a pretty disappointing experience. And I think, you know, if you look at the data and the statistics for hedge fund returns, you know, over the last, you know, dozen years, and there are all sorts of survivorship bias issues with this data, but even allowing for that, you know, some of the, you know, the average hedge fund has done, you know, really rather poorly. I think, you know, you clearly have to believe that you're picking good ones and that you know why you're picking good ones, you as an investor. you know, for hedge funds really to justify their existence.
It's kind of adjustment of expectations to reality. Would you agree to this, that maybe the number of outliers on the right tail got a bit lower, so that average return that investors are casting is now closer to what is reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's possibly right. Or I think the other thing which, you know, one notices is that, you know, some of the outliers, you know, are small little, you know, are things which are difficult to scale, which are, you know, would be relatively small hedge funds if they were to set up on their own, but that they, you know, they're funded by hedge fund platforms, you know, which, you know, look after the fixed costs and the infrastructure, etc. You know, so if I can make supernormal returns with $50 or $100 million, that might not be big enough for me to, you know, justify setting up a hedge fund. But if I can go to a platform that provides me with, you know, the ability to do that, and I just hire a couple of guys, and I don't have to worry about compliance and systems and settlements and stuff, then perhaps that is a that seems to me, at least from the outside, to be one of the ways that the industry is going.
We always conclude our episode by asking our guests for three pieces of advice they would give to their younger self. What are yours?
Possibly the advice, this is maybe not generic advice, this is maybe generic, this is maybe sort of advice that would be good for the 23-year-old Steve Mobbs with his quirks and characteristics. I think the first thing I probably didn't realize when I came out of university, you know, somebody who'd sort of, you know, built a career and a self-image for himself out of being, you know, clever, was that really to be successful in a career, it's better to be clever than smart, but clever is one of the, it's less important than you think it is. And, you know, there are an awful lot of other skills that you need to have. Now, probably everyone listening to this recording actually realizes that, but I think I was rather slow to realize that. And I, you know, as a rather, you know, kind of intellectually arrogant, you know, person in their mid-20s, luxuriated in being clever and expected to be patted on the back for being clever. And, you know, clever is a tool, and it's not, you know, it's not the most important tool. And, you know, if you work in quant finance, you're quite used to hiring very clever people, some of whom are successful and some of whom are not successful. You know, some of the ones who are not successful never quite figure out what other skills they need as well as being clever. So that's the first thing. What's the second thing I'd say? Well, I think I'd say take control of your career and be aware that there are going to be, you know, certain big opportunities that are going to come along. And, you know, I think you have to recognize what those opportunities are. And I think when you look back at my age, when you get to my age and you look back on your career, there will be two or three moments when you made a decision that really made a difference to the outcome. You know, if you'd made a different decision, the outcome might well have been quite different. So, you know, I don't think you can, you know, a lot of things that happened to me were in fact, you know, good fortune and serendipity. And I think looking back, I could have probably tried rather harder to take control of my career and to be proactive about it. And I think I would probably encourage other people to be more proactive maybe than I was. I think I was fortunate that when the opportunities came along, I seized them. But I think I might have tried rather harder to purpose things, you know, my way. And I think the third thing is to recognize that there's an awful lot of luck involved in a career, being in the right place at the right time, you know, the timing of a particular market, you know, and being identified with that market, or, you know, or getting on with a particular person and that particular person getting taking you with them, or, you know, getting the opportunity. You know, I guess to some extent you make your own luck, but, you know, there is luck involved, and a lot of, you know, whether you're successful or not, you know, can be quite path dependent. You know, if you happen to set up that fund just before that crash, you were never going to succeed. There's no chance of you succeeding. If on the other hand, you happen to surf the wave of setting up at a time with benign market environment and you had good performance for 2 or 3 years, it's a lot easier than it is if you set up in a difficult time. And there's not much you can do to control that. So you need to be kind of philosophical about it, I guess, and accept that there is luck involved. And I guess keep trying if you get knocked down and are unlucky. So those are three thoughts anyway.
Thank you, Steve, for sharing your wisdom and for spending time with us. Really appreciate it. Speak soon.
Not at all. Thanks a lot, Nikita. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking to Legends. I hope you found it to be useful and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this show, please write a review on iTunes to support us. Stay tuned.